Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, County, Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe, Tallapoosa, Glen Rock, Black Rock.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumbo Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumbo Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumbo Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you so much, Audrey. Are we really worldwide? Worldwide? I mean, someone in the North Pole could hear us if they had an internet connection. Is that right? That's right. So it is worldwide. And we could hit the South Pole and who knows where else. Unfortunately, we probably don't hit very many places at all. But anyway, welcome to Blog Talk Radio, ladies and gentlemen, the Jumbo Justice Radio Show. I'm your host, Keith Haley. We're going to try it one more time. We're going to have a nice show tonight. We're going to study something that most people don't know Zip about, and I'm one of those people. I don't know Zip. How about Guantanamo? We're going to depend on Book TV one more time to provide a top author who studied Guantanamo, and of course, that's a debate in presidential election. Should we have it? Shouldn't we have it? We're supposed to do away with it, and we haven't done away with it yet. On and on and on. What do we do about all facets of this business called terrorism? And that includes what do we do with people who we lock up for that very offense against our society. But anyway, thank you very much for joining us. And I want to thank Johnny Cash for taking us on that ride. Hey, I hope that thing going on with the sun and all that doesn't bother Johnny out there on the road with the trucks. But anyway, I think you'll be okay. Emily, Mike, Audrey, thank you very much tonight. Lucy's not with us tonight, ladies and gentlemen. She's traveling. She'll be back next week. But we want to thank all of our staff, which are just excellent, top people who could be working anywhere as opposed to the Jumbo Justice Radio Show. What we're going to do, discuss what we usually do, discuss news issues and events and developments and the always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. Some of our news stories tonight, I would think, would fit in the humorous category. Some about what thieves are stealing nowadays. Last week, I think we talked about gasoline. Well, they're stealing other things, and they're going at it in a strange way. But anyway, we dedicate this show to the energetic and competent and tireless police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the United States and throughout the world. We want to look inside what they do and in their practice and learn something from it. And there's always something to learn in the field of criminal justice. Tonight we're going to start off here in a moment here with some news, but we want you to know that you could get a Blog Talk Radio Show also, and you could sign up literally. There's probably a record for this, but you can literally sign up in probably 5 minutes and maybe even be broadcasting your show in 10. And instead of being goofy about it, I'm actually going to see how many shows Blog Talk Radio has in the time that it's been on. What year is this, Mike? This is 8? Is it that long? 8 years they've been on, something like that? I think we were in maybe the first, I don't know, several hundred, I know. But anyway, you can have your own show. If you have an organization, you have a cause, you want to talk to some folks, you can do it worldwide to an unlimited number of listeners, and it doesn't cost you anything. That's the marvel of the age we live in terms of transmission kinds of electronics. The shows are archived also under in our MP3 format, and you can go to those and pick them up and play them later if you want, and some people actually do that, we're told, for criminal justice classes and that sort of thing. You can call in during our little news segment. Our segment here tonight on the Guantanamo prison facility is kind of a long one, but we'll talk about some news here in just a moment. Well, I think Audrey has a blonde joke, and we want to go ahead and take care of that. Audrey, can you fish out that blonde joke you've got? Oh, actually, it's three of them tonight. I remember you telling me that. It's actually three blonde jokes that Audrey has. So we'll listen to these. Go ahead, Audrey. Audrey?
Driving. Question, if blonde and a brunette fell off a building, who would hit the ground first? Answer, the brunette. The blonde would have to stop for directions. Joke number two. The assistant asked the blonde if she would like her pizza cut into 6 pieces or 12. 6, please, she said. I could never eat 12. And finally, joke number three. A blonde was walking down the road with a healthy-looking pig under her arm. As she passed the bus stop, someone asked, where did you get that? The pig replied, I won her in a raffle.
That's not our crew. A little technical difficulties there, but we will get over. Thank you very much, Audrey, for doing those encore three short jokes for us. And I like the one falling off the cliff. That's a good one. Okay, we also have a little green book for you tonight, in case you haven't been paying attention to the planet and how warm it's getting, and I'm sure it's getting much warmer. You could probably tell that, at least where we live in northern Ohio, because it's pretty mild winter. I mean, we got away with something here. And this one says, this is an save the planet. And this one says that, look, if you're worried about your impact on the environment, as we all are, you can hire an environmental auditor to assess your carbon footprint. You can go to www.carbonfootprint.com, if you haven't done that, that's a trip, and find out how you can make changes. Many companies now have specialists who will actually come and visit your house and help you figure out your carbon footprint and how to reduce it. Now, what a service that might be. I don't feel motivated right away to call one of those consultants, but I'm sure people this very moment are probably asking for assistance and assessing their carbon footprint, really something. Well, ladies and gentlemen, guns are always an issue in our society, and we want to support the Ohio Coalition against firearms. And what they're trying to do is get criminals to turn their firearms in. So let's go ahead and play their public service announcement, Mike.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Thank you very much, Ohio Coalition, and we love playing that puppy service announcement, because I know probably, I'd really like to know how many, but as that announcement goes out over the air worldwide, I suppose criminals all over the place are going down and turning in their guns and their firearms. Okay, I think it's time for a little criminal justice news. There's always some news, of course, and we've got some good ones here tonight. Some of them are... Some of the stories, a few are a little bit odd. Let's see what we can find in this first story here. Okay, it worked. If you had to make a guess about which type of musical instrument was stolen the most, which instrument do you think that would be? Does anyone know or have an idea? Well, in Los Angeles, it happens to be tubas. Tubas, why? Says schools here, they still have their trombones and their trumpets, their cornets and their clarinets. But high school marching bands in Southern California are going tubaless these days, and the music directors think they know why. There's a band of bandits on the loose, they say. Someone they believe who is breaking into high schools from the east side of Los Angeles to the shores of Manhattan Beach and stealing expensive tubas to supply a fast-growing banda music black market. Can you believe that? Once little-known north of Mexico, banda has become the fastest-growing genre of Latino music in the United States over the past 20 years, and it's particularly popular in Los Angeles. This is where musicians gather in places. In the city's mariachi plaza to offer their services to parties, weddings, and other kinds of events. Musically, it's appealing because it's so dynamic, says one commentator here. He's a cross-cultural music expert, apparently. And he says, of the fast-paced, joyous dance that sprung from polka tunes that German and France immigrants carried to the Mexican state of Sinaloa. Who knows, in the 19th century. So it has a German and French origin. How about that? But anyway, and when this thing plays, it's not the drum that keeps the beat, it's the tuba. And the tuba goes oompa, oompa, oompa. So what they're doing, these bandits are breaking in, or a guy, one woman, who knows, they're breaking into high school band rooms, and they're taking these tubas. And you know what these things cost? They cost about $6,000. And when these characters get these used ones and steal them, they can go out and sell these things for about $3,000. So if you're out getting four tubas a night, that's not a bad evening work, is it? That'd be, $12,000, not bad. But who would ever believe that the tuba, in fact, my view would have been that the tuba is kind of fading as you're in a, high school marching band. You don't see it while symphony as you do, but anyway. Kind of an interesting idea. Poor Detroit, they're probably having trouble again. They're going to be audited, and they were part of an $11 million grant program. I hope you're sitting down. Intended to provide business attire to 400 low-income job seekers who would have a job interview. In other words, if I'm going to go get a job interview, Detroit got $11 million to set up a boutique where if you had a scheduled interview, you could show that, and you could go down and get a new set of clothes so that you could go and look good in the interview. Well, out of the $11 million, would you guess how many people Detroit, or could you guess how many people Detroit has served to this point? It's only two. Not 200, not 2,000, two people. And they don't know what happened to the other 10 point whatever million dollars. But the city's auditor general for the period found that the department failed to control the operations and finances of a boutique that was to provide the clothes. I would say if they serve two people and $10 million is missing, there must be something wrong there. There's a couple things odd here. First of all, certainly terrible management. But secondly, where in the world did we get the idea that we could suit some people up and pay for it, and so they could go get a job interview. And I assume if you're on unemployment and you've been here a while, you're probably not going down to apply for the CEO job for General Motors. You know, who knows what you're going for, but I would say a better grant program would be to have them learn how to make clothes. At least they'd be learning a skill there, and then they could wear those clothes. But can you believe that $11 million grant supposed to help 400 people get their clothes? 400 into 11 million, boy, that's an expensive outfit. But, you know, there's other things involved. But is that weird or what? This came out of the Circuit Court in Dallas, U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. And this is a federal decision, apparently. And guess what? They've discovered or decided that it's okay for a police officer to search your cell phone without a warrant. Some places have been doing this. I think Michigan State Police have been stopping people and looked at the cell phone and all that. But that Fourth Amendment, remember that one? The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, and papers and effects against unreasonable searches and seizure. And no warrant shall issue, but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, particularly describing the places or things to be places to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Yeah, we love the Fourth Amendment. But anyway, they're tossing out, somebody says, well, it's on your cell phone. What could they be looking for? In this age, if you've got a cell phone, iPhone, Droid, or whatever, and you have cloud storage, you can have more stuff stored on that cell phone than you could have in five office buildings, couldn't you? Right? Yeah, I think so. Audrey's shaking her head. She believes it. And now we're letting cops do that type of search without any type of warrant whatsoever. Or apparently no even, I guess, maybe reasonable suspicion. Doesn't even mention that. That they need even reasonable suspicion. That's what you would need for a stop and frisk, where you could pat somebody, pat someone down. But, ACLU does not like this, and some other people think this is going too far. This pushes the envelope on privacy issues, and they're wondering if this opens the door for more extensive searches down the road. When you lose your Fourth Amendment rights, you probably lost a lot of things. this is kind of interesting. The head of the Newark FBI said Wednesday that the Newark City Police Department monitoring of Muslims in New Jersey has had a chilling effect on the Fed's ability to gather counter-terrorism intelligence. Remember what we talked about that last week? New York City Police sent their cops out to universities in other states to do monitoring of Muslim student groups. Like, they counted how many times they prayed a day, and apparently none of this turned up fruitful in terms of uncovering any kind of thing, but in the process, any type of terrorist operation. In the process, they stayed in, luxury hotels. They did all kinds of things. And we found out that this money, I don't think I told you that either, this money came from a drug grant. So apparently this is supposed to have been spent on narcotics or something, but we'll hear more about this. But the FBI in Newark is saying this hasn't worked very well for them. The FBI office in Newark has 100 agents. They have a 1,000-member counterterrorism unit in New York City. Oh, my gosh. Can you believe that? And just think about that. These units are all over the United States, and we're collecting all this information. I suppose you could say if it saves one life or, you know, one prevents one bad incident, it's all worth it. But there has to be a cost-effective, cost-benefit discussion about this. So this somehow just incredible. Los Angeles residents are being warned about burglars who are entering their homes through their doggy doors. I don't know how big a doggy door is. I mean, Mike, how big is a doggy door? Could you get through? I don't think I could get through a doggy door, but apparently somebody can. Authorities said that there have been at least 7 to 8 of these kinds of burglaries in the West Valley area recently. The suspects entered through the doggy door and sprayed the pets with some type of pepper spray. How cruel. Does Peter know about that? Police said that they've all seen more cases where the suspects break into the house from the second floor using a ladder. Yes, that's called talented burglars. So anyway, they're recommending to residents that who have dog doors to put an alarm on the dog doors on the second story of their house, and that would prevent some of this stuff from actually happening. Okay, there. Here is the mom. I guess you heard about the soccer mom. Did we talk about her last week? Yeah, where she's running a brothel in New York City. Yes, she's a soccer mom, and she has apparently four kids on the Upper East Side, and her real job apparently is running a brothel. And they've tied all kinds of politicians apparently to this who've attended and various kinds of things. And apparently she makes pretty good money at this. And she herself is one of the providers of services. And they say that this has given the New York City Police and others a bad name. I can just imagine what happens with something like that. All right. One more and then we'll get to... Guantanamo. It's a hacker story, and it takes a long time to explain, but you've been reading in the news, even news clips on radio, you can hear the talk about Anonymous, the great hacker organization, and how they're involved in some things, and this other hacker organization where the guy who was the head of it was actually working for the FBI, and they've broken into all kinds of things, and this is going to be never-ending. Because there are people who love computers, there are people who love to use computers to cheat and commit fraud and all sorts of other things. Well, that's it for the news segment tonight. Now we're going to turn to this show about Guantanamo Bay. Hold on just one second, please. Do we make a real switch here of browsers? And the gentleman that's presenting this book, he's done more than one, is Jonathan Hansen. And he's... a lecturer in social studies at Harvard University, and he presents a history of America's presence at Guantanamo Bay. Guantanamo. Most people wouldn't even know how to pronounce that, right? I don't either, unless I look real close. But anyway, the authors report on the United States' early interest in the area and now the central role that it plays in plans to control the Gulf of Mexico and the Caribbean, and now the creation of the naval base and the prison at Guantanamo, and of course that is a major point of debate. But it's an interesting history how we get caught up there in this little tiny part of Cuba. So anyway, here we are with Jonathan Hansen. Give me time to get it set up, and I think you'll enjoy this presentation.
Up next on Book TV, Jonathan Hansen presents a history of America's presence at Guantanamo Bay, examines the creation of the U.S. naval base and prison at Guantanamo, and its continued usage despite calls for its closure. It's a little over an hour.
I want to thank everyone for coming. Tonight is very special because we have C-SPAN Book TV here filming Jonah's talk. And that will be on TV in a few weeks. And during the question and answer section of the talk, we'll ask people to go over there to the mic so the questions will be heard. I just want to say that this event is sponsored by the Friends of the Belmont Public Library, and we're thrilled to have Jonathan Hansen here tonight to talk about his book, Guantanamo, An American History. His book details America's centuries-long fascination with Cuba, from the Founding Fathers' plans to expand U.S. commerce via control of Guantanamo Bay, to today's notorious prison for enemy combatants. Many of you may have seen his op-ed piece yesterday in the New York Times entitled Give Guantanamo Back to Cuba, and I'm sure that people will have some questions on that later on. Jonathan Hansen is a lecturer in social studies at Harvard, and he is also the author of The Lost Promise of Patriotism, Debating American Identity, 1890 to 1920. And I just want to say that the author's series, as I said, is sponsored by the Friends of the Belmont Public Library. Aideen Storer designs the posters, Miriam McNair takes care of publicity, and Emily Smith does the website. We also want to thank Maureen Connors, the director of the library. And I'm Jenny Altshuler, and Farida Tetsawala, and I do the authorship. Thank you, Jonathan. Come on.
Thank you, Jenny. I want to begin with a heartfelt thanks to the Friends of Belmont Library for inviting me to speak to you guys tonight. It's wonderful to be in the company of people who like books, people who appreciate the gift that is a book, not to say that my book is a gift, only to say that book lovers appear to be a fairly endangered species. So thanks to Jenny, thanks to C-SPAN, thanks to Belmont, finally thanks to all of you for turning out on what is a school night. It's nice to be among friends, and friends of friends, and maybe friends to be. Although friendship, of course, doesn't imply agreement. I look forward to questions, comments, criticism at the end. Come to think of it, skeptics, naysayers, enemies are welcome too. This is, after all, a public library. I begin with a riddle. What do a 16th century Taino Indian chief, a 17th century French corsair, an 18th century American colonist, a 19th century U.S. contraband slave trader, a fugitive from Castro's Cuba, and an HIV-positive refugee from Haiti have in common? Anybody? To get the full answer, of course, you have to read the book. But here's a hint. All saw Guantanamo as a promised land, as a land of second chance, a springboard that could bring them closer to their dreams of peace and plunder, freedom and opportunity, reunion and rebirth. Now, the idea of Guantanamo as a promised land fits uneasily with the place we come to know post-9/11. And this evening, I'll try to illustrate that claim by telling the story of one of the characters from that opening riddle, the 18th century American colonist, in this case, Lawrence Washington, half-brother to more famous George. But first, I want to be sure to slake the appetite of those who turned out tonight expecting to hear something about post-9/11 Guantanamo. So that, too, is a critical part of the book. Perhaps like many here today, I became interested in Guantanamo in the spring of 2004, when the Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib scandals were breaking over the media. As a U.S. historian interested in the political, legal, and moral boundaries of states, I was curious about a place thought to be beyond the reach of Cuban, U.S., and international law. For you may remember that in the aftermath of 9/11, the Bush administration defended the denial of constitutional protection to the Guantanamo detainees on the grounds that Guantanamo was simultaneously sovereign territory of Cuba and hence outside U.S. constitutional jurisdiction. And yet at the same time, within the special maritime and territorial jurisdiction of the United States, hence beyond the reach of international torture prohibition. Now, the argument that Cuba was sovereign at Guantanamo contradicted what I thought I knew about the Spanish-American War and the subsequent U.S. occupation of Cuba. So I decided to take another look. What I discovered refutes the Bush policy emphatically. The United States seized the bay from Spain in one of the opening salvos of what Americans are fond to call the Spanish-American War. We retained the bay during the subsequent U.S. occupation of Cuba, and we forced Cuba to lease us the bay as part of a notorious Platt Amendment, which brought the formal occupation of Guantanamo to a close in May 1902. In short, Cuba has never been sovereign at Guantanamo Bay. It's U.S. law or nothing there. The book also pushes back against recent attempts by Bush administration officials to justify their calamitous policies at Guantanamo and elsewhere, on the grounds, first, that the terrorist attacks were so heinous and unprecedented that no other response could be imagined. Second, that the U.S. public unanimously endorsed such response. Third, that criticism of Bush policy amounts to Monday morning quarterbacking. And fourth, that the torture of prisoners at Guantanamo and elsewhere is all that stood between America and another terrorist attack, all of which is nonsense. Criticism of Bush administration policy at Guantanamo and elsewhere has not emerged only recently, nor has it emanated largely from liberals or outsiders. Internal opposition to the policies unfolding in Washington was immediate and unequivocal. The the fact that many high-ranking Bush administration officials, many of them new to the challenge of national security, chose to ignore the counsel does not make it go away. Well, then, if a unanimous call to protect Americans at any cost did not drive U.S. detention and interrogation policies at Guantanamo, what did? I think there are many ways to explain the debacle, but all of them coalesce around the politicization of national security policy at the expense of expertise, anti-intellectualism in American life. A leading authority on torture insists that democracies become torture when military influence overwhelms civilian political institutions. But in the case of Guantanamo, the reverse seems to be the case. The torture and abuse that occurred there is attributable to the transfer of national security policy out of the hands of seasoned military and national security experts into the clutches of an intimate group of political ideologues. Think Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, David Addington, Douglas Feist, and John Yoo. I'd be delighted to return to post 9/11 Guantanamo in the Q&A. For now, I want simply to acknowledge that there is something new and indeed criminal about the Bush administration's attempts to write torture into law. And yet at the same time, I want to question the fairly widespread assumption that post 9/11 constitutes a historical anomaly, a fall from grace. Does it indeed? The answer I want to suggest depends on one's historical perspective. Okay, so let's stretch our gazes back before the American Revolution to the expansionist dreams of an overpopulated and economically strapped, stagnant set of British colonies sandwiched between the Appalachian Mountains and the Atlantic seaboard. For only by beginning at the beginning can we truly understand Guantanamo's abiding presence in the United States history for what it is, namely a product of the nation's liberal political economy, that is, its universal moral and political aspirations on the one hand, and its unslakable appetite for land, labor, resources, and markets on the other. Now, to be sure, our liberalism makes us generous. Anybody can be a part of this great American Republican experiment, at least in theory. Yet at the same time, our liberalism makes us presumptuous, often predatory. What's good for us is good for you, whether you like it or not. That paradox is visible in America's conquest of North America. It's there in our interaction with Latin American states. It's there in our contemporary involvement in the Middle East. And it's there in our continuing occupation of Guantanamo Bay. Now for a little history. My story begins on July 18, 1741, when British Admiral Edward Vernon led 62 ships bearing 3,000 British troops plus 1,000 Jamaican slaves through the entrance of Guantanamo Bay. Among the British troops were several hundred American colonists, survivors of a much larger colonial contingent that had joined the British expeditionary force the previous autumn, targeting Spain's New World settlements in the War of Jenkins' Ear. Arriving at Guantanamo, Vernon took an immediate liking to the bay. He visited the bay not 10 days before renaming it along the two rivers and selecting the ideal spot on which to build a new city. He was not alone in thinking this, in his words, the finest harbor in the West Indies, with room for all the shipping in the Thames. Americans, too, he was quick to report, begin to look on it as a land of promise already. So who were these Americans? Just a year earlier, most of the 3,300 colonists mustered into the original British ranks had been struggling to make ends meet in a sluggish colonial economy. At home, a burgeoning population combined with conflicts along the colonial frontier to limit access to land. Abroad, a Spanish monopoly on trade to the West Indies throttled colonial commerce and industry. The result was a society characterized by frenzied geographical activity, mobility. Whether running from debt, skirting the law, or leaving a chance, these Americans were desperately on the move. Lured south by a promise of a share in any booty which shall be taken from the enemy, the American colonists met with crushing disappointment upon arrival in the Indies. Within a matter of days, some 300 colonists were stricken with yellow fever, which, along with dysentery, cholera, malaria, and scurvy, claimed more lives than did any Spanish arms. Inexplicable delays plagued the campaign from the start. For over 2 months, it languished in Port Royal, Jamaica, the British stronghold, thus forfeiting the element of surprise, inviting further disease, and introducing the colonies to that particular brand of snobbery, British disdain. In this unhappy climate, Vernon stood out not only for regarding British and colonial interests as one and the same, but for his frank solicitude for the Americans. An experienced politician as well as a seasoned sailor, Vernon was drawn to the more cultivated Americans, and to one in particular, Lawrence Washington, a 23-year-old captain in one of the Virginia companies. British educated and immensely ambitious, Washington came to Vernon's attention for his leadership in an unsuccessful assault on the Spanish bastion Cartagena. Back in Port Royal after Cartagena, Vernon struck up a lasting friendship with young Washington before they embarked for Cuba and Guantanamo. Now, no record survives of Washington's and Vernon's conversation in the wardroom aboard Vernon's flagship, the Boeing, but it's possible to imagine something of its content. Washington likely confirmed Vernon's impression that all talk in the colonies was of land. Washington himself grew up in a family for whom land is a vehicle of wealth and advancement rather than a means of subsistence. From the year 1657, when Lawrence's great-grandfather John Washington first arrived up the mouth of the Potomac, the Washingtons had proved themselves keen speculators and cunning bachelors, snatching up much of the Tidewater's fine real estate along with several of its most eligible brides. Augustine Washington, Lawrence's father, was a surveyor, a vocation that afforded him firsthand knowledge not only of the Virginia countryside, but also of the frontier territory west of the Appalachians. Now, Lawrence was every bit his father's son. Exposure to the ravages of war could not distract him from the issue of the day. "I hope my lots are secured," he wrote Augustine from Port Royal, which if I return, I shall make use of as my dwelling." The lots in question consisted of 2,500 acres along Little Huntington Creek, Virginia, which Augustine had transferred to Lawrence just before he embarked to the Indies. Called Estewasson at the time, Lawrence would rename his Virginia estate Mount Vernon after his Guantanamo interlocutor. Besides describing his plans for Estewasson, Lawrence likely confided to Vernon his hopes for the Ohio country, which, judging from his activity upon returning to Virginia, was always topmost on his mind. Home by January 1743, the year his father died, Lawrence carried on in the family tradition, marrying the wealthy Anne Fairfax, forging powerful social and political alliances, pursuing his land and iron interests back and forth across the sea. Lawrence's transatlantic peregrinations paid off in 1747, when along with a group of prominent Virginia and English investors, he founded the Ohio Company of Virginia, eventually winning a grant of 200,000 acres near present-day Pittsburgh, PA. Now, those who thought to tap the resources of the Ohio country had to figure out a way to bring its fruits to market. It was simply impractical to carry it east over the Appalachian Mountains to the old ports of Baltimore, New York, and Philadelphia. Better to ship it down the Allegheny and Ohio rivers, ultimately to the Mississippi River and Gulf of Mexico. This only raised bigger questions about access not only to the French port of New Orleans, but also to regional and hemispheric shipping lanes at the time largely in control of Spain. Here's where Vernon must have cut in. Had Washington not already heard it from his father, the surveyor, he would almost certainly have learned from Vernon that plans for developing the American hinterland seemed as on command of three key waterways: the Yucatan Channel, the Florida Strait, and the Windward Passage. Now, the Mississippi River drains into the Gulf of Mexico, as everybody knows. But the Gulf of Mexico is part of a regional circulation system that governs access to its various parts. current in the Gulf of Mexico flows clockwise. It enters through the Yucatan Channel and exits through the Florida Strait. In the age of sail, travel against that current was difficult, often impossible, which meant that ships accessed the Gulf of Mexico through the Caribbean Sea. Finally, the Caribbean in turn has many entryways, but few deep passageways. Passages, none deeper and more convenient to Europe and North America than the Windward Passage on which sits Guantanamo Bay. In short, Cuba was the gravitational center around which this system churned. The country that controlled Cuba would command the trade and traffic not only of the Atlantic seaboard and North American continent, but of the Western Hemisphere itself. Britain arrived at Guantanamo that July with high hopes. What he found exceeded his expectations. It was not simply that Guantanamo afforded ready access for Santiago de Cuba, Spain's second capital in Cuba, nor that the bay could absorb the entire fleet, nor that it offered better protection from tropical storms in Port Royal, nor finally that it was ideally situated to safeguard British shipping throughout the Caribbean, all of which is true. What put Guantanamo over the top in Vernon's mind was its native splendor, its navigable rivers, rolling hills, and fertile plains. And yet, from the beginning of the expedition, a fatal disagreement between the Navy and the Army doomed the expedition to Cuba. Despite a surprising absence of Spanish troops and an open road to Santiago from Guantanamo, the British Army never advanced. When after 9 days at the bay, neither the absence of the enemy nor the establishment of a secure camp induced Vernon's Army counterpart, General Thomas Wentworth, to move, Vernon set off to canvass the local countryside on his own. Descending the ladder of the Boyne, he boarded a longboat and headed up the Guantanamo River. His delight at what he found apparently exaggerated by his fear of losing it. "I thought it the most beautiful prospect I ever saw," he wrote the Admiralty back in Whitehall, to Guantanamo. "To row 5 leagues up a navigable river of about 100 yards wide all the way, with green trees on both sides appearing like a green fence." Skirting Wentworth's camp, he crested the hill to come face to face with the finest plains in the West Indies, bordered by the river the farthest navigable. Wentworth, meanwhile, occupied a rise along the river, as beautiful a situation for a town as any of this country can afford, with a fertile soil behind it. It takes only a little imagination to wonder if that could have been the site of the original Mount Vernon, and those Vernons in Washington's mind. Now, glowing accounts of Guantanamo began to sweep the colonies just as Vernon came to recognize the campaign was over. In early autumn 1741, newspapers up and down the Atlantic seaboard announced almost accurately that Admiral Vernon was arrived at Santiago de Cuba and that land forces had got safe ashore at a village a small distance from the city. More detailed descriptions of Guantanamo accompanied British transports north. "The finest harbor I ever saw, a pleasant island far exceeding all the West Indies that I have been in, a country laden with cattle, goods, and horses, a place as healthy as a man can wish, no one of good beasts, tabaricus, wild hogs, Indian corn in abundance, water plenty and pure, as good as any I've seen among us." These just some of the images calculated to distract beleaguered colonists anticipating another long winter. "Rig out and make the best of your way here," one writer urged her friends, "for I make no doubt that we shall in a very short time have quiet possession of the whole place, and then first come, first serve, now or never, for a plantation on the island of Cuba." Unfortunately for the Americans and their supporters, British land officers did not share Vernon's enthusiasm for the campaign, as I mentioned. Colonial troops overheard the Europeans, as they called them, protesting being asked to expose their lives for procuring settlements for the Americans. This is actually one of the earliest instances of the use of Americans to describe the colonists that we know of. In a military lacking unified command, the Army's opposition to this venture was enough to carry the day. As the odds of delivering his land of promise dwindled, Vernon consoled himself with the thought that he had at least understood the Americans correctly. "I think my inclinations have been entirely conformable," he wrote, "to what I believe is the principal motive of all the American officers of engaging in this service. the hopes of being settled in the West Indies and in Cuba preferably to all other places. Weeks of running with Wentworth had left Vernon dispirited and ready to return to higher latitudes. Still, the wistful admiral could do nothing but stand aside as his American dream went up in smoke. "We discerned the huts of the camp to be on fire," he reported on November 16th. Mr. Wentworth, having marched down with his remaining well men and embarked on board His Majesty's ship, the Grafton. Cruelly to Vernon himself fell the burden of completing the stealth immolation. 3 weeks later, on December 6th, a Sunday, he set fire to a fine new fast-beam battery at the center of the bay and sailed out of Guantanamo, never to return. Now, the Americans, by contrast, would be back. Not these Americans, to be sure, not anytime soon, but soon enough, before any rival power, including Spain, could occupy Guantanamo and exploit its riches. Few of the original American recruits survived the expedition. Massachusetts sent 500 troops and returned 50. Rhode Island sent 200 troops and returned 20. Astounding figures replicated throughout the colonies. Lawrence Washington was among the fortunate to return to the colonies, thus securing Edward Vernon's place in U.S. history. But Washington left Cuba with more than a new name for Esterhazy. A stubborn case of tuberculosis accompanied him home. Late in 1743, it blossomed by the end of the decade, ultimately killing him on July 26, 1752, at the unripe age of 33. It was left to Lawrence Washington's half-brother George to transform Mount Vernon from a solemn epitaph to a bungled military campaign into the triumphant symbol of a new nation. But the more Mount Vernon became associated with its new owner, the further its connection to Guantanamo Bay receded, so that today Guantanamo's place in American history is all but forgotten. But Guantanamo was there at the beginning, and it has been there ever since, reflecting, sometimes shaping, the aspirations and institutions of the people who like to call themselves Americans, and of the American people to whom they have been so closely and controversially tied. Okay, so there's a taste of historical Guantanamo. In the time remaining, I'd like to say a few words about where we are today. Incidentally, I always thought that audiences should be suspicious when historians turn to discuss contemporary affairs, and that they should run for the door when we move into the future. But given the subject and the occasion, the 10th anniversary of Guantanamo, the opening of the Guantanamo prison, I hope you'll indulge me just a little, but we can have some nice debate at the end of the talk. So on this, the 10th anniversary of the opening of the Guantanamo prison, it's safe to say that the Guantanamo prison enjoys more public and political support today than at any time in its 10-year history. In poll after poll taken since President Obama took office, Americans have overwhelmingly rejected the idea of closing the prison and transferring its population stateside. In December 2010, just before ceding its majority, the democratically controlled Congress dealt a near-fatal blow to the administration's effort to close the prison by prohibiting the president from transferring detainees to the United States, from buying or constructing a prison on U.S. soil, and from repatriating detainees without a signed guarantee from the Secretary of Defense that free detainees would not return to battle, something no Secretary of Defense's right mind would ever give. All these provisions, incidentally, were enacted without parliamentary debate and virtually without any public notice. Just 13 days ago, on New Year's Eve, the President signed the new National Defense Authorization Act, which reinforced last year's legislation and then some. The President's apparent capitulation on the prison only confirms what the polls and politicians have been telling us for the last several years. We are all Guantanamo now. I'm curious how many of you noted this past November the opening of the first military tribunal to occur on Mr. Obama's watch. When Guantanamo officials arraigned Abd al-Rahim al-Nashiri, the alleged mastermind of the 2000 Cole attack on USS Cole. I think 17 Americans died. This case is a capital case. Al Nashiri's commission goes forth next week. Should the Guantanamo Commission declare him guilty, the president will find himself in the awkward position of presiding over the first military execution there. One can only imagine the headlines emblazoned across media throughout the world. Guantanamo execution, Obama puts to death detaining U.S. torture Al Nashiri, admittedly. So how then in the world has this come to pass? Much of the responsibility, I think, belongs to the Bush administration. For Al Nashiri is no ordinary defendant. Captured in the United Arab Emirates in 2002, he was transferred to U.S. custody and taken to black sites in Afghanistan and later Poland, where he was waterboarded, threatened with an electric drill and mock execution, and warned that his family would be treated to the same treatment if he didn't tell his interrogators what they wanted to hear. After arriving at Guantanamo in 2006, Al Nashiri retracted a confession given under torture about his leadership of that Cole attack. The strongest evidence against him now appears to consist of second-hand hearsay, inadmissible in federal court, by the way. Salim Hamdan, the convicted driver of Osama bin Laden, told an FBI agent he overheard Al Nashiri boasting of planning the Cole attack while at an Al-Qaeda safe house in Afghanistan back in April 2001. The degree of coercion that produced that information is anybody's guess. Some of the responsibility rests with Congress, determined to maintain and exploit the fear that allowed the American public to turn a blind eye on Bush administration crimes. Conservatives in Congress have managed to convince hitherto rational individuals, like New York City's mayor, for instance, that trying to accuse terrorists in federal court would be too dangerous, too costly, and too lenient. Notwithstanding the record of successful federal terrorism prosecutions and the fact that sentences in such cases have tended to be far more severe than those meted out by the Guantanamo Military Commission. In the case exemplifying the supposed inability of the federal court system to handle terrorist crimes, Ahmed Dahlani, the alleged planner of the 1998 East African Embassy attack, was given a life sentence, while Hamdan himself tried at Guantanamo in the last military commission before Obama shut the system down, was given 5 months in addition to time already served. And the charges on which the two were convicted were essentially the same, that is, material support for terrorism or conspiracy. It's worth emphasizing that the longest sentence handed down at Guantanamo, again by contract, is 9 months. Yes, you heard that right, 9 months, to Australian David Hicks. Meanwhile, as cowed now as they were in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, congressional Democrats are only too happy to play along. This is equal opportunity blame pointing. Reluctant to be accused of being soft on terrorism, they joined the Republican majority in blocking transfer of detainees, or merely reconcile themselves to the status quo. One listens in vain to what one presidential candidate used to refer to as straight talk on Guantanamo. But surely much of the responsibility rests with Mr. Obama himself. In August 2007, candidate Obama told the Woodrow Wilson Center for International Scholars that as president, he would jettison the Guantanamo Military Commission. As a venue for trying terrorists, he observed, Guantanamo was a perfect failure. Mr. Obama vowed to close Guantanamo, reject the Military Commissions Act, and adhere to the Geneva Convention, thus demonstrating to all the world, these are his words, that law is not subject to the whims of stubborn rulers and that justice is not arbitrary. I'm aware that election campaigns are aspirational. How could we not be in this season? The challenges confronting presidents are practical. Still, Mr. Obama insists that a series of reforms carried out after he took office put the Guantanamo commissions on a par with federal courts and military courts martial in terms of constitutional safeguards. The logic alone refutes him. If the standards are equal, why do we need both? Moreover, military tribunals have historically been objects of last resort rather than of political convenience, which they appear to be today. The Al Nashiri case exudes the risk of an administration cherry-picking the venue which seems most likely to produce a favored outcome. hardly evidence of a judicial system depoliticized. Furthermore, by allowing for appellate review while at the same time admitting hearsay evidence and ignoring the Sixth Amendment's safeguard of confrontation, among other defects, the revamped commission virtually guarantees that guilty verdicts will be mired in protracted appeal. In short, the candidate got it right. The Guantanamo commissions are unjust and unnecessary and not the path to swift justice Americans deserve. But Mr. Obama bears responsibility for the position in which he now finds himself in another way. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it, the philosopher George Santayana once remarked. I doubt that history repeats itself, but there's ample evidence of it haunting those who ignore it. Why has Mr. Obama failed to deliver on his promise to close the Guantanamo prison? The president can't move forward, I want to suggest, because he's been unwilling to look back. There's been no rigorous public accounting of the crimes committed there, and no account of how they fit into the more distant history. So if I can repeat my history a little bit, post 9/11 Guantanamo is not the historical anomaly we like to believe. In selecting Guantanamo as a place for a prison to hold detainees beyond the reach of U.S. constitutional protections, the Bush administration chose a site that had been used that way before, in the 1990s under Presidents Bush 1 and Clinton, when as many as 85,000, that's right, 85,000 Haitian and Cuban refugees were detained behind barbed wire at Guantanamo Bay in two separate episodes, some for up to 2 years. That policy in turn dates back to the 1970s, when U.S. immigration officials first broached the idea of using Guantanamo as a holding facility for Haitian boat people unwanted in Florida on the same grounds. With no due process at the bay, the United States could process the refugees out of sight of fine journalists and human rights lawyers alike. And so the record goes. It strikes me that an American public armed with the facts about recent and more distant U.S. activity at Guantanamo would seem less likely to remain complacent about it. An informed, galvanized public is a sine qua non for shuttering both the prison and the military commission, and thereby saving Mr. Obama from compounding Guantanamo's and America's notoriety. So where does this leave us going forward? And this is where some of you might run for the exit. Well, in the face of these developments and this impenetrable block on closing the prison, I've come to conclude that if President Obama truly wants to close the prison, the most realistic way to do so at this point would be to begin negotiations with Cuba to return the base itself. They neither need nor want the base, and I've heard this in person, and only hold on to it as a goodwill gesture to fellow military branches and to the State Department. In short, it's taking one for the team. Guantanamo is expensive. To me, the debate over whether to shutter or make permanent the prison obscures a much deeper failure that dates back more than a century and implicates all of us, left, right, and center, namely our continued occupation of Guantanamo itself. I think it's past time to return this colonial legacy to Cuba. From the moment the United States government forced Cuba to lease the bay in June 1901, the American presence there has been more than a thorn in Castro's side. It serves to remind people the world over of America's long history of interventionist militarism. Few gestures would have a salutary effect on the current stultifying impact in American-Cuban relations just handing over the base. Bear with me as I return one last time to the historical window that preceded the U.S. occupation of Guantanamo.
Again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know, tell them I